A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Books Podcast with me, Claire Armistead.
And me, Richard Lee.
This week, Richard talks to the Scottish poet and essayist Kathleen Jamie about climate change, the North, and death. And later, we speak to TV producer David Parker about another writer with a strong connection to the natural world. But first, the poet Kathleen Jamie won the Forward Best Collection Prize in 2000 and 2004 and the Costa Poetry Award 2012 with her collection, The Overhaul. But she's also a talented writer in prose, exploring Scotland and the North in 2005's Findings and Sightlines, which appeared in 2012. When she came to the studio to talk about her latest work in prose, Surfacing, she began by taking us to the far west coast of Alaska, where a village elder is casting his eye over the latest finds from an archaeological dig.
There was one elder who was particularly interested in the dig. The name he used was John Smith. John was a youthful 68 or 70, small of stature. Like most of the men, he usually wore thick checked lumberjack shirts and workman's jeans. He'd often drop by of an evening to see the day's finds, especially any pieces in walrus ivory, because he himself was a carver. One day, the excitement was an earring that had been found on site, carved of walrus ivory. It was a flat platelet, about a centimetre square, with two smaller pendant circles, a bit like owl eyes. The plate itself had been carved with a dot amid concentric circles. John took the earring into his hand, turned it, scrutinising it. "How old is this?" he asked. 500 years. How'd they do that without metal? Make those perfect circles? He looked at us and said with reverence, "What kind of people were they?" "Your kind of people, John." We'd often hear John make remarks of wonderment and of sadness for the culture which was past. "There are no Eskimos anymore," he said, "all gone." John could remember sealskin covered kayaks on the river. "All gone now, and dog teams and dog sleds. Now everyone uses outboard engines and snow machines. Too much noise." "Do you know how to travel by dog sled?" we asked. "Yeah, I know." He nodded, paused. "You need 7 dogs, smart ones. They will find their own way home." He made a motion with his hands, exactly like the paws of a running dog.
Surfacing brings together 3 strands. There's a trip to Alaska where you spent time digging up the remains of a Yupik village that was abandoned 500 years ago, and a trip to Orkney where the archaeologists are discovering objects that have been buried for thousands of years. There's also a section exploring a trip you took to Tibet 30 years ago, a journey which required a kind of archaeology of a sort of more personal kind. Was that the kind of connection, or the digging?
I never set out with a theme in mind. It's only after the whole thing's done, after many years, you know, I can look back over this accumulation of work and think, oh, that's what it's about. So in this case, it seemed that, Surfacing became the eventual title because every piece I'd written seemed to be linked by things coming to the surface, be it of the earth physically or, as you say, mentally, emotionally.
Yeah, because that's very much the experience as a reader. You, as a reader, you realise that you've gone somewhere else, but somehow it feels right that you've gone there. That's how you assemble it, is it? You kind of follow the thread and see where it takes you.
Yes. In hope and faith that it will cohere in the end. It would be so much simpler if I could set myself a theme and say, right, Kathleen, for your next book, you're going to concentrate on...
bananas.
Bananas, you know, and bananas of the world, you know. A lot of air miles, but it would... give me something to aim for, but I can't work like that.
In Quinnahawk, you find a mixture of ancient and modern ways of living. You find hunter-gatherers, as you say, with a grocery store, which made me think that William Gibson's line about the future is already here, it's just unevenly distributed, could also apply just as much to the past.
Does that mean the past is here?
Past is still here.
Oh, yes.
But
yeah,
just unevenly distributed.
That's... Since I was a teenager, I've been fascinated by the way the past is manifest in the present to the extent... I wanted to be an archaeologist when I was younger, but for various reasons didn't. But I'm still alert to that and still fascinated by it. Yes, it's here amongst us, you know, taking notes, I think.
And sometimes more revealed than at others.
Yeah, for sure, physically and as you say, emotionally. And I'm fascinated also by what in 100 or 1,000 years will be remaining of us, and if we are spared and live that long, what will people in the future look back to us and say, what were they doing? You know, which I think will be the case.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's kind of stuff, isn't there? I mean, there's stuff that you find in Alaska. There's arrowheads, dice, wooden masks, and so on. But there's also stories that handed down for generations. The people, you say, they didn't give information. They instead tell incidents and anecdotes, like coming at a subject sideways, not straight on. So what's the difference between giving information and telling an anecdote? What do you gain?
Well, I wasn't there long enough to get deeply or understand deeply how that their culture works. But I did get the strong impression that information is shared and is held in common, because in a hunter-gatherer society, you will starve otherwise. Whereas in our society, information is power, as you know very well, in a newspaper building. Yeah, and power accrues information and guards it.
So it's the withholding of and the distributing of,
exactly,
that gets
so
you access.
And in that society, which is still largely a hunter-gatherer one, you can't withhold information. You know, if the geese are arriving, if there's a bear in the dump, you know, everybody's got to know. You know, whereas ours, well, it gets worse every day.
Well, I mean, it's extraordinary, because it's almost like a manifesto for the book, this idea of looking at something sideways. Is that your own personal method as well?
In as much as I'm not an activist and I'm not a pamphleteer, I'm a poet, you know, and Emily Dickinson famously, tell the truth but tell it slant. So there may be something in that.
When you meet someone who's been collecting stone arrowheads, but she tells you that she's never been to visit the dig where the archaeologists are discovering things that are being melted out of the tundra by the approaching seas. You say that you didn't want to press for explanations, which made me just stop for a moment. Isn't that kind of the writer's job to ask awkward questions?
No, it's a journalist's job.
Which is a different thing.
A different thing altogether. I much prefer an approach which doesn't interrogate people. They didn't ask me to come there and interrogate them. Why should I? You know, and there are sensitivities and things withheld and things unsaid that I have to respect as well. And I think that what I do discover comes out of listening rather than out of interrogating.
Hmm. And you discover different things by that process.
I should imagine so, yes. And make yourself slightly more popular as well.
Very much so, I'm sure. But I'm just wondering... I'm wondering if you can put your finger on what the difference is between those two things.
Between interrogating and...
The things you find when you do those. If you are to interrogate, what do you miss? If you're...
You miss the gift, I should imagine. And when people do divulge something, it's a gift given, and one would hope freely given.
You also say that people in Quinnahook notice, you say, the opposite of our contemporary urban living.
They're very, very attuned to the natural world and the landscape around them. Absolutely have to be. So it's refreshing to be with people who are acutely aware of what's going on, what's arriving, what's growing, how the clouds are, when, you know, our society is less so. We'd give that over to, well, give it over to experts, don't we?
Absolutely. You also say that whenever they talk about food, it inevitably comes a conversation about the land or the sea.
Yeah, yes.
Again, are these kind of ways of pointing out sideways again, pointing out sideways just how unnatural 21st century modern living is?
I guess so. If your food comes immediately from the land and the sea around you, and yes, you're not going to test it. There is a grocery store in the village, which is a very strange thing. But by and large, the people are getting fish from the river and, you know, snaring birds and what sometimes harpooning walruses. It's full on hunter gathering, and so therefore their immediate source of food is still the land, still the sea. And so if you are talking about the food on your plate, they immediately say, oh, you know, caught it yesterday.
And where it was from. And
where it's from and why that's coming, why the migration of these salmon is arriving now. And once the salmon have gone through, something else will be in season. You know?
Yeah, but it's a culture that's on, it's under threat in some sense. I wanted to ask about the walrus, because I remember in the book that one elder talks about how he insists that they have to remember, they've got to remember these things, because if the planes stop flying and no food comes in, we've got to remember how to live.
Indeed. It's probably true for all of us, but they're acutely aware of it, and we ain't.
But that was the thing. I mean, because here in The Guardian, we're 3 days away from the supermarkets running out of food if the lorries stop running.
Aren't you so? That's what they say, isn't it? You're 2 days away from a bread riot.
Mm. You know? But, I mean, is that partly why you wanted to go north? Because it's kind of so much more starkly pictured.
I do like the starkness of the north. Mm. Yes, I do like it when the trees stop. Never mind the aeroplanes, I like that kind of landscape. But it was the thought, what attracted me to that particular place was the idea that the evidence of these people's cultural past was being revealed to them because of climate change, which was raising the sea levels and eroding the land. And that little nexus I found absolutely fascinating.
You know? Mm. Because, I mean, I'm not sure if we've explained already that the dig, the archaeological site, owes its existence to the fact that the tundra is being swept mm-hmm. away.
Yeah, it's right on the very edge of the land, and the rising sea is very quickly eroding the land, and the tundra is thawing. So the permafrost, which had things in its grip, is now loosening that grip. And the upshot is that this village, which had been buried, is now revealed. You know, and it's a pre-contact village, which means that everything that pertained to the people's hunter-gatherer lifestyle is intact there. And so it predates any contact with missionaries especially, you know, and with European settlers who told these people that their life way was, you know, just ignorant savagery. So they're coming out at a time of intense self-doubt, you know. And these objects, these exquisite artifacts are, so the archaeologists hope, revitalising and regenerating a cultural confidence at a time when they're sorely going to need it because of climate change.
Because, I mean, you're looking back into the distant past, but because of things happening right now, and that's the same in Orkney as well.
It's a strange thing that the Yupik village is only, in quotes, only 500 years old, but 500 years ago they were living a completely hunter-gatherer lifeway. The village in Orkney is Neolithic. So in terms of human development, if you like, it comes after hunter-gatherer, but it is 5,000 years old because we in Europe adopted farming and the people in the remote places where things can't grow, basically, retained their hunter-gathering lifeway much, much longer. So time gets all into a swirl, which I quite like.
It's also very apt for examining something like the climate crisis, which is at such inhuman timescales that we find it difficult to think about.
It is difficult to think about, and you know, I think it helps if you don't think of time as linear, but as I say in the book, think of it as a spiral and things coming around and going around and coming into proximity with each other. I can cope with 1,000 years, 5,000 years, even 10,000 years, but once we get onto geological timescales, who can think like that? It's amazing. You
know? It's a different kind of brain, isn't it? Yeah. I mean, I guess, but I mean, I was struck by the woman who runs the youth club on Westray, who says that even though we know we can't go on like this, we wouldn't go back either.
Yes, yeah, we do seem to be.
To the stone plowshare and the early death.
Exactly.
We're stuck on these kind of 0 hours contracts. We've got the rising seas lapping at our feet, but we still want to watch Netflix and get a takeaway. I mean, do you also feel the pull of turbo capitalism and all its terribleness?
Well, I do like my laptop and, you know, yeah, I wouldn't want to go around in a hair shirt and eating God knows what, you know, eating seaweed. No. But we're going to have to find a way of navigating this, aren't we?
Yeah.
It's exciting times.
Yeah. Because the idea of a return it might appear appealing at first. The death stalks the book as well. There's that realisation in Kinahock that you'd never be here again. And then all the way through, and then at the end you find your father finishing his dram in his chair. Did you know that it was going to be about death?
No, because my dad's death occurred much after everything else in the book, but it found its place in the book because we are talking about time and human lives and how our mortal lives are pegged against a greater span of time, you know. And as I'm now in my late 50s, so I have a sense of the arc, the shape of a life that you don't have when you're 20, you know. But now if I'm spared, I can get a sense of that shape and pinning that, as I say, against a sense of greater time spans. I just find all that stuff fascinating. Time, I think, it's my obsession.
Have you finished the book in Selva Oscura? But here in the Anthropocene, surrounded as we are by a savage, dense and harsh wood, is the answer to concentrate on the world around us?
I do wonder if noticing, the simple act of noticing, can be almost a political act when we're surrounded by so-called leaders who are horribly high-handed and disregarding, you know. And it might not, we might not win, but it is an act of resistance against that attitude, you know, of gross dismissal. So noticing and being in every moment, it might not save the world, but, you know, it can just, you mean you're not doing what they want you to do, just for a minute.
But what about dissent? What about blocking up traffic like Extinction Rebellion?
I think that's absolutely marvellous, but for me personally, I'm not an activist, although I might be, yeah, you never know. Hitherto I haven't been an activist. Because of what you said about coming at things slant, I think an activist knows what they want, they can articulate exactly what they want, and they know how to get it. But writers like myself, and I'm a poet primarily, we don't yet know what we want. Only after we've done it, you think, ah, right, that's what that was about, as I said to you. So good luck to them. Good luck to the young ones. Good luck to the protesters. But I think there are, or at least I hope, that I'm doing something, but in an alternative mode and playing to my own strengths as a writer.
I want to ask about that. What about hope? Is that something that a writer like yourself, is that something you can do?
Do you know, I was just thinking about this coming down on the train. Why am I hearing the word hope? Well, maybe it's obvious why I'm hearing the word hope so much. But why am I so often being asked if I'm purveying hope or if I have hope? I'm detecting a note of desperation coming into the question. Where do we find hope? Yeah. I don't know any more than anybody else. Yeah. If I was peddling hope, I'd be some sort of religious minister, wouldn't I? Which I ain't.
That was Kathleen Jamie, and Surfacing is published by Sort Of Books. She leaves us with a very interesting question, Richard, which bubbles up every now and then, which is the question of hope in literature. Is it the duty of writers to create hope for readers, or should they be able to find it for themselves?
No, I'm always very alarmed about giving writers duties. I think I was saying this on the podcast last week, but I mean, I must say that we could all do with a bit of hope right now. So I find myself turning to books that aren't entirely bleak, rather more than ones which are heading towards oblivion.
And that's something the publishing industry itself has picked up on, isn't it? And there's quite a lot of there's this whole uplit genre, which we might come to a little bit later. But where does this leave dystopia, which we've been told has been the craze of the last 10 years?
Well, I'd sort of had this vague feeling that dystopia was kind of gone, finished, or was past. It was a wave that had receded. But actually, when I went to look back at what's been published this year, I mean, there's Margaret Atwood, the joint Booker winner with The Testaments. There's John Lanchester with The Wall, Joanna Kavanagh with Zed, Ben Smith's Doggerland, Sandra Newman's The Heavens, Joanne Ramos, The Farm. I mean, it's just still coming and coming and coming and coming. But I mean, perhaps this vague sense that I think I had that dystopian fiction was on the wane is because there was that massive peak around the time of The Hunger Games, which I think a third of those was published in 2010, I think. And there was this slew of titles kind of in the wake of that massive success. And perhaps that has begun to fade. Or maybe publishers have begun to wake up, as you say, to the commercial implications of books that are entirely bleak.
It's interesting that I'm thinking about John Lanchester in this context. The hope that he offers at the end of The Wall is that there is somebody still there to tell the story.
There you go, there's a crumb for you.
It is a crumb, you know. And but this is a bigger point, isn't it, about how writers create a sense of hope. It's not all about they go dancing off into the sunset, is it? It's sometimes no. It is as small as that, just a tiny little morsel of of the possibility of continuation. And I mentioned Uplit before, and this has been, do you think this is a bit of a busted flush as well? I mean, it sort of peaked with Ellen Oliphant is Completely Fine in 2017, a couple of years ago, quite a long time in publishing terms.
Yes, that was a big year for it. The first in the wave, we might like to say, might be The Unlikely Pilgrimage of Harold Fry, which was Rachel Joyce's in 2012. And then there was The Trouble with Goats and Sheep, another notable Uplit title in 2016. But you're right, the year of it was 2017 with Eleanor Oliphant and also Matt Haig's How to Stop Time, which is very much a kind of positive sort of spin on the science fictional kind of love story.
Matt's character, Tom Hazard, the appropriately named, has this lovely line, why worry about the future? It always happens. That's the thing about the future. I mean, but the thing is, we're actually in a position now where that isn't a given anymore, is it? I mean, with all this panic over climate change.
Yes, with people predicting societal collapse within 5 years or whatever it is. So it does feel like the future is rather more tenuous than once it was.
Since 2017, when that novel came out, which means that Matt was thinking about it and writing about it a couple of years earlier, that the landscape has really changed. You know, there's also this feeling that nothing could be as bleak as the news we have at the moment, which is not just about climate, it's also about the wave of right-wing populism going across the world, dictatorships resurfacing.
So perhaps all the dystopian fiction that we actually are still publishing, it turns out, is beyond that idea of trying to compete with a reality that's already bleak, which I suppose brings us back to Margaret Atwood.
Yeah, when I interviewed Margaret and Bernardine Evaristo just after they'd won, on the morning after they'd won the Booker, and I actually asked them how you know, whether they felt hopeful, and they both didn't feel hopeful inevitably, but it did raise the question of what they've done with their novels, and they both said interesting things. Margaret Atwood said a pessimistic ending would be to kill everyone off in a novel like hers, and she said the ending of The Testaments is not optimistic for everyone in the story, but it does signal the beginning of the end. Or as Churchill said, this is not the end, it's not even the beginning of the end, but it is perhaps the end of the beginning. And maybe the end of the beginning is optimistic enough in the circumstances, which is, again, that's coming back to the crumb of hope, John Lanchester's crumb of hope. But Bernardine said something rather different. She said she too was finding it very, very hard to be positive in the current climate. But she said, but with the characters, I did not want to present 12 black women who were defeated by life, even though that is sometimes the case. So there's definitely hope in each of their narratives without it getting saccharine. And for her, that's a question about giving them some sort of power over their destinies and their lives, even when they're very old or they're very disadvantaged socially or economically.
There's more than just a crumb there, isn't there?
Yes. So I think, you know, I think that, you know, and it's, maybe it's not a coincidence that these two novels won this literary prize in this year. They offer something, some sort of vision beyond the terrible trudge of blackness and bleakness with which we are confronted at the moment. After the break, we'll be hearing a voice from...
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
From the past. Welcome back to the Guardian Books podcast, where we're heading to a pond in Gloucestershire.
Well, we're down at the bottom of the valley on the edge of Slad. This is really our village pond. It's about half a mile, but it was the centre of all our juvenile recreations, summer bathing and winter skating and general gathering together. We called it Squire Jones's Pond. He was he he glorified in having this ancestral or almost feudal possession of this place, but he never held us, he never checked us, our license, or we were unlicensed and could do what we wished. Oh, but it's still a free gathering place, and it's inhabited by coots and moorhens and dab chicks.
That was the voice of rural England, more specifically Laurie Lee, a perennial fixture on the exam syllabus with his vivid memory of his country childhood, Cider with Rosie, and his moving portrait of 1930s Spain as I walked out one midsummer morning. Lee was talking to the TV producer David Parker in 1994 in one of a set of interviews recorded to mark the writer's 80th birthday. Now Parker has transcribed these interviews in which Lee records his village youth and published them as a short book, Down in the Valley. He joins us from Bristol, which is about 30 miles from the village where Lee grew up.
Slad is in just north of Stroud. It's one of the five valleys running into the town, and it's the one that Laurie Lee made famous in Cider with Rosie, of course. And it was famous historically because all these five valleys were driving woolen mills for the woolen industry in the 18th century.
So what was it like when you met him in 1994?
It was extraordinary, actually, because he told me on the phone, and his agent had told me, that he didn't do interviews, certainly not television interviews. So when I wrote to him to ask him if he'd do one for me, he telephoned me at home, and my son answered the phone on an answer machine. And he was charmed, I think, by my son's answer, and invited me to come up to Slad, to the pub, to the Woolpack, lovely pub, by the way, to meet him. And we had a terrific hour. And then I think we just got on, actually. I was surprised how well we got on. But at the end of the conversation, he said, "Why don't you come with me in your car and I'll take you to one or two places around the valley." And he took me to three or four places, the Pond, Bull's Cross, Swift's Hill. And in each location, he got out of the car and he told me a story, and it was absolutely fabulous, mesmerising, actually. And I thought, what a wonderful storyteller this man is. And I persuaded him to let me come back with a tape recorder, and I taped him. And that seemed to go well. And then I persuaded him to let me come back with a film camera, and we filmed him. And I spent five glorious days in the spring of 1994 with Laurie in these wonderful, wonderful locations.
And that's how you remember him then, as a storyteller?
A fantastic storyteller, yes. A storyteller who could always end his particular story with a wry smile and a sense of humour. So one example I'll just give you, when we were talking to him about poetry, and he was remembering how he wrote a really marvellous poem about winter called A Christmas Landscape, and he finished it, and then he said, "That's 7 o'clock, the church bells are ringing, the pub's open, I think we should stop." And just like that, he was really superb, actually, yeah.
And so is that the secret of his enduring appeal?
I think his enduring appeal, it's a complex appeal, I think, actually, but one element of it is, I think, this sense of a period, looking back on a period, that where we felt perhaps more comfortable with our lives than we feel today. I mean, he paints this rosy picture, doesn't he, really? Cider with Rosie. Rosie's got a double-edged meaning because it was a rosy world. Although in the interviews with me, he said that don't be mistaken in thinking that we weren't anything but incredibly poor. We were, but we didn't feel poor. And just stories about playing around that landscape, playing around the pond, you know, investigating the world of the young adolescents, girls and boys, is something I think that appeals to people. But then I think also his writing is sort of universal, I think, actually. If you take As I Walked Out, I mean, somebody leaving home, taking a chance, going away, working on a building site, you know, breaking away from family and then coming back to family. These are some of the sort of universal truths, I think, that we all face as people growing up. And I think he appeals to that across different generations and across different time periods. And his writing is so beautiful. It's so easy to read. It's so easy to read aloud. I mean, he's got a beautiful style, I think.
His style was something of a reaction to the ways of speaking which were all around him, as he explained back in 1994.
They had very compact vocabularies, but they told stories with such command of their vocabulary. They meant perhaps 200, 500 words. They never had to hesitate and grab and use second-hand clichés and say, at the end of the day, let's have a level playing field, and having said that, and all this jargon you get with second-hand Westminster, Palace of Westminster, not Westminster Abbey, unfortunately. Well, that's gone too. They speak the same language now. But to have that command of language that these valley people had, they could tell a story as the mariners in Homer's day must have been able to tell, a complete command of a very effective vocabulary, born in them, nourished in them as they grew up. And they could set your hair on end, retelling the old dramas of the valleys. I've tried to do my best to keep away from that because I realised that in telling a story, if you use somebody else's language, they're not going to be interested. They're not going to read it. But try and describe something as you're looking at it and engage their attention by telling them what it was like to see this for the first time as a boy.
Laurie Lee speaking to David Parker. Down in the Valley is published by Penguin Classics. Thanks to David and to Kathleen Jamie. And that's all for this week. Next week, we chat to Rory McLean and Luke Harding about Russia. If you have any thoughts about this week's episode, get in touch on Twitter at Guardian Books or on the podcast page. And please do subscribe and review us wherever you get your podcasts from. But for now, from me, Claire Armistead.
Me, Richard Lee.
And our producer, Esther Opoku-Jenny. Thanks for listening and goodbye.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.